Welcome to the Project Zion podcast. This podcast explores the unique spiritual and theological gifts Community of Christ offers for today's world.
Hello, and welcome to the Project Zion podcast. I'm your host, Carla Long, and today I'm super excited to talk to John Hamer. This is a topic that I've been thinking about for like 2 years now, because I'm going to tell a story about it.
Okay.
So I was talking with a seeker, and she said to me, she goes, so Carla, you're a bishop. I'm like, yeah, I'm a bishop. And she goes, well, where do you get your priesthood authority? And I go, from God.
Good answer.
She didn't like that answer at all. She thought it was a little bit like, no, I mean, where do you get your priesthood authority? And I had no idea what she meant. Like, I literally had to contact somebody else and be like, okay, what did she mean by this? And it was explained to me, and hopefully you're going to also explain it as well, what she meant by that, where I got my priesthood authority, and why she thought my answer was wrong, and why I thought my answer was right. So that's what I'm talking about today. I'm all about priesthood authority. So, John, before we jump in, why don't you, well, you're probably no stranger to anyone on this podcast, but go ahead and introduce yourself and tell us a little about you.
Sure. My name is John Hamer. I serve in the priesthood calling of 70 in Community of Christ. I also am pastor of the downtown Toronto congregation here in Canada. And one of the things that we do here is our congregation right now in the pandemic is kind of at the center of what we're kind of calling our global congregation, as we are producing streaming content every Sunday and Tuesday and Wednesday, and have as many as 1,000 disciples and seekers around the planet in more than 50 countries who join with us for the services. And it's just been very, you know, anyway, obviously in the middle of very trying times, it's been one of the nice things that we've been able to achieve is come together in this new kind of way.
It's been amazing. You guys
have
such a phenomenal job. I've been so impressed. It's been really, really good.
Thank you.
So you're a busy guy. Let's be honest about that. You're definitely a busy guy.
I only have about 400 more slides to make before tomorrow in order to get the service ready.
Let's go slow with this podcast. You have plenty of time.
Yeah.
So, John, can we jump back to my little story?
And yes.
First of all, I guess overall, what do we mean by priesthood authority when we say priesthood authority? The Mormons, not necessarily us. What do we mean?
So we mean a lot of different things, unfortunately. And that's one of the reasons why we can have very much competing answers that talk right past each other. It's the same exact thing. If you were to meet with a born-again Christian and they ask you, are you born again? And we can just very easily in Community of Christ say, yes, you know, when I was baptized, I was born again, because we understand that baptism as a sacrament and a covenant where we are born into a new life in as part of the body of Christ. They have a different idea of what they mean by born again, right? And so they have there has to be a special moment in life where you have a kind of emotional, psychic, you know, internal response where you feel like you've been touched in a very particular way and have turned your life, and it doesn't occur during a sacrament or an ordinance. It takes place, you know, as a direct contact with the Holy Spirit in their understanding of what that means and why that's essential. And so that's not to say what they're saying is bad or that that's, you know, we shouldn't, that they couldn't, you can't have an important spiritual experience like that, but that's not how we understand in Community of Christ anyway, the phrase biblical about being born again. And so in the same way, authority is also one of these questions that Christians have been in debate about, and it actually has a long historical background. And so I can say in Christianity, traditionally throughout from late antiquity through the Middle Ages, Christians understood four sources of authority or why we do what we do, how we know that we're justified in believing certain things and acting in certain ways. as Christians. And so the those sources were, on the one hand, scripture. On the second hand is the testimony of the earliest Christians. So sometimes called the Christian fathers, because it was mostly men, unfortunately. But anyway, the testimony of the early Christians, and so what those folks wrote about. Three is tradition. And four is apostolic succession. And so the idea that the ancient and medieval Christians had, that there had been Jesus Christ as a historical figure, that he had in history ordained certain apostles. The apostles had in turn ordained bishops who had ordained other bishops, and so on in an unbroken succession all the way to the present. And that's still the position of anybody, generally speaking, who has a church that has bishops who can trace their bishops all the way back. The main problem with it in terms of a historical argument is nobody can trace their bishops back, you know, before really the second century. And the next portion of it, this idea that there had been this, that Jesus had set up a church on the one hand, and that there had been apostles who were, you know, set up and they set up bishops, doesn't seem to have been, doesn't, you can't make, you can't prove that historically in any event. And there's reason to imagine that that's not really how, for example, the church in Rome was being operating until later. So that they, this, the bishops asserted authority by the time the historical record starts getting going. But it's a problematic claim. So anyway, so that's one issue. And so then what happened in the beginning of the modern era, the people in Northern and Western Europe wanted to reform certain things with the Western Church, so the Latin Church. And so among those things was the a movement, for example, called conciliarism, which instead of having the church be led by a single bishop, the Bishop of Rome, the Pope, as we sometimes call him, they were suggesting that actually an ecumenical council, a universal council of the bishops, is actually a higher authority than any one bishop. And so that would have been one idea. So in other words, it's an authority question. And they also began to dispute, so that's a argument against apostolic succession as the, you know, as instead. So instead, it's a kind of a proto-democratic one, where, in other words, we are all the representatives of all of the of Christians, and specifically would have been the bishops at first, but ultimately it becomes kind of what we do with the World Conference and Community of Christ, which is to say every member of the church in a congregation elects a delegate to the Mission Center Conference and their Mission Center, and the Mission Center Conferences elect the delegates to the World Conference, and that becomes the highest body, the legislative and every body in terms of the church. And so that actually can canonize and decanonize. In other words, so the World Conference expresses that. So that's kind of that our understanding of that is actually kind of born out of these reforms. The reforms ultimately become Protestantism, and ultimately breaks the Western Church into pieces instead of reforming. And so after that, the Protestants argue anyway that they have a doctrine that they introduce, which is called sola scriptura, which means scripture is the sole source of authority. So where is your authority from if you are a Lutheran? The Bible, right? And so when that, the answer to the question that your Mormon friend asked you, for where does the Lutheran minister get their authority? It's ultimately derived from the Bible, because anyway, the Bible is the sole source of authority. So in the Restoration tradition, which is born out of Protestantism, Mormons often think of themselves as being quite different from Protestants, but in fact, the entire foundation is Protestant. So the Restoration tradition is born out of Protestantism, but it changes essentially the understanding of authority a little bit, because the goal initially is to restore the church to be what was then called the primitive church, what we might call the apostolic church. So this church that people can read about in scripture at the time of Acts and also in the time of Paul's writing his letters. But it's also, unfortunately, as I've already mentioned when I was talking about Catholic claims, it's also a time that isn't really very historical. So in other words, although the people in the time of the Restoration very earnestly believed that that was a historical period, and they wanted to restore everything to be like that. In fact, it doesn't actually exist as a historical period, but in any event, that's kind of the goal. And so we want to restore, and so there was an idea then that was floating around that's not original to Mormonism, but is part of even Protestantism and specifically primitivism. So the other reform and restoration movements, there's an idea that during late antiquity and through till modern times, that there had been a great apostasy. And so that the church in the Middle Ages wasn't valid. So it's writing off the entire inheritance when you also are getting rid of the Pope. So it's a further level of denying, we're denying now that we're not going to be part of the Catholic Church, but we're now going to call the whole medieval church the Catholic Church, you know, and we're going to try to instead trace our roots back to the earliest component of the church and say, in essentially, that we are identical to that. And so that is... that essentially is the goal of this. And so in so doing, the restoration created ideas or arguments of it, that were actually evolving themselves. But the goal of it was to say we have the we're the Latter-day Saints, you know, which is to say, because this is the latter days now, and the saints as it was the name for Christians in the New Testament times. And so those are the primitive saints, and we're the Latter-day Saints. And so now but there's a continuity, essentially, an imagined continuity between those two and everything in the middle, that the intervening 1800 years of history, or whatever it is, 1700 years, is all being thrown away with the bathwater.
You know a lot of stuff. Oh my God. You just know this off the top of your head. This is amazing. Second of all, I wanted to make a comment about the restoration of the, what Tony Chevalier Smith has called, there's no original recipe for the church. And sometimes I hear people talking about, oh, you know, the church that Jesus built. I'm like, Jesus didn't really build a church.
Right.
So anyway, I appreciate all of that. So that's excellent history of why we need to talk about priesthood authority and where it comes from.
Yeah.
So we have a lot of seekers that listen to this podcast and a lot of Community of Christ people, and I don't know where the two meet. So if we could talk
That's where we kind of led to in this historical thing. I was kind of trying to give a little context for the Protestant and Catholic and everything background, but now we're going to get to how did ideas of authority emerge in the Restoration.
Absolutely.
And those evolve rapidly too. So it's not, there's not just one way that authority is understood. And it's, let's say, the way that the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints understands it now. They understand it in quite a different way than the earliest beginnings of how members understood it. And so initially, for example, you can kind of track even the earliest ideas by reading the Book of Mormon and by reading the Book of Mormon in order of author, how it was written. So it was written starting from the Book of Mosiah and to the end, and then the beginning part is the last part written. And so actually what happens kind of early on in the composition of the text is that they are trying, there's a need that's felt by the characters in the Book of Mormon, by a guy named Alma, the elder who has led his people off into the wilderness. They have a desire to have a church. And so this is actually very different from what had come before. So before, we'd had no real church. There was a king, Benjamin, who was giving a speech. That's the earliest part. And he doesn't one time tell of a need for baptism or anything like that. They don't have that understanding yet, Joseph Smith and Oliver Cowdery and the people around him. But then by the time they get to Alma, they'd have a desire and a need for understanding baptism. And so how did they, but they don't know how to make it happen, because where does the authority come from? And so Alma goes off into the lake and he prays, and the Spirit descends on him, and he essentially self-baptizes himself. And then he starts baptizing everybody else. And so the initial idea of authority is like that. And that's essentially how it starts simultaneously in the Restoration tradition. So although the story is later changed and reimagined and understood that there's potentially a visitation of John the Baptist or something like that. The original way that this would have been understood is just like in the Alma story. So the Spirit descends on Joseph Smith and Oliver Cowdery, who baptize each other. And that's where baptism kind of starts. Now, the ideas evolve later about what the church, you know, the church's authority and need and keys and priesthood and all these kind of things, but they don't have all of that yet. You know, so they have, first off, it's just the Spirit and baptism, and it's described very kind of clearly in Alma. But then things do evolve, you know, and so to get to the place where, frankly, the RLDS church was in the middle of the 20th century, and also it would be understandable to where, it's not the same, but it would be understandable to people in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, is this idea that that priesthood, legitimate priesthood, was taken off the earth during the Great Apostasy, and then it is restored at the same kind of time period of the early church down in Harmony, Pennsylvania. And so then on the understanding of how this works then is that various priesthood keys, whatever that's meant to mean, are brought back to the earth by angelic visitations, potentially, Peter, James, and John, and so on and so forth, that restore both Aaronic and Melchizedek priesthood. The problem with this later story is that it's anachronistic. It didn't occur at the time. It was, we can tell that these ideas of Melchizedek priesthood didn't exist at that time in the church. But it's later understood to have happened at that time, and that's how it's understood now. But the idea then is that there was a whole time period where, and so I'll just say that that's kind of where that you kind of get to this. It's the idea of that kind of authority then is one of that is history based, and it's also very literalistic, and it's very exclusive. And so the exclusive source of authority on the whole universe, frankly, you know, is arriving for tiny groups of people first in Judea, Palestine, in Roman times, and then is taken from the earth and is restored again to a tiny group of people in Pennsylvania, and then everybody else, you know, doesn't have, you know, throughout all of history and all time and everything like that, doesn't have legitimate authority or a legitimate connection in that sense. And so that was our position, I would say, also in the RLDS church, which is that our church, as of, like, let's say 1950, was the one and only true church on the face of the earth, the only one that had the proper full proper structure, all of the offices that you needed, all of and everything else in order to be the true Church of Jesus Christ on the earth. And so that would have been how the authority was understood. And I think that's still kind of how it's understood in the LDS context. And I mean, the main issue again is the same problem that I argue with about apostolic succession for the Catholics. The stories of the both, let's say, getting the keys are anachronistic. Both the Melchizedek priesthood establishment story is an anachronism that didn't happen at the time, and this it's a story that's created later. And the story, for example, that that also the LDS Church looks to about that's actually establishes plural marriage, but now what they call just celestial marriage, sealing, the sealing power. That's a story that is again, anachronistically put back to the Kirtland Temple time period, where there's a visitation of Christ in the Kirtland Temple. The problem with that, again, is that those ideas of plural marriage and everything like that didn't exist at the time. So it's a retrospective thing. And then finally, the core problem with the argument that your authority comes from that is that then Joseph Smith's killed. And so how do the keys continue? And so there's a principle that if in this view, this exclusionary view, why didn't it have an apostasy again, just like in Peter and Paul's time? And the answer actually is it would have. And the reason why is that by this idea of authority, the lesser cannot ordain the greater. If you run out of elders in your congregation, you cannot get the deacon to make a new elder. Likewise, when you run out of prophets, you cannot have apostles ordain new prophets. That's not because that's because a lesser can't ordain the greater. And so there is an idea that retrospectively gets injected into the narrative from the LDS side that Joseph Smith had distributed the keys to the 12 prior to his death. And that's, again, anachronistic. They're referring actually to ceremonies that he did when he was creating a council of 50, which is unrelated to church keys. He's just reestablishing something called the kingdom. It has nothing to do with the church and church succession or priesthood, which is restored completely. Priesthood is restored before the church is restored, so it is not related. So anyway, that's not the case. And then two, the polygamy revelation itself that is in the Utah LDS DNC says, no, the keys can only be held by one man a time on the earth. So you can't distribute them to 12 people no matter what. Anyway, so it's not a, there's no way you can make the canonical argument for it if you have that position in my view. That's my position. So anyway, so we abandoned it, I would say, in terms of like, okay, so how did we make that argument though beforehand? And so the idea of it is that there's a couple different ways. And so the idea of it is in the Doctrine and Covenants, it says if Joseph Smith falls, he shall have no power save it be to appoint another in his stead. So there's the scriptural basis. Several times in his life, he appointed his son as the successor. And then in terms of the, if you're going to use this kind of key-based argument about ordination, William Marx is the person who ordains Joseph III, president of the church. William Marx, as president of the presiding high council, was equal in authority to Brigham Young. And so you would, neither one of them, in my view, in terms of the argument, since you can't have the lesser ordain the greater anyway, but in any event, they're the same. And so therefore, the same level of kind of keys would exist going through those two lines. But it, like Joseph Smith III always said, his authority isn't coming from some kind of earthly thing where you have a humans that are given some kind of authority over all other humans, but rather his authority is from God. And indeed, I would say our understanding of this now and in Community of Christ is, which is not that we have exclusive authority, but rather that we have our own special calling and other people all are called. In other words, that the Holy Spirit is working not just on earth. The universe is huge, and so it's not just one little group of people, It's not just Christians. Anyway, so that the Holy Spirit is working in all kinds of different ways, and we don't limit God. But that doesn't mean we don't have a special calling. But our understanding of authority now is that Christ didn't come to be the kind of on-earth celestial dictator of an authoritarian regime that maybe many people thought he would at the time. So in other words, they assumed the Messiah was going to come and create a political kingdom that would impose all of God's will on the planet. And instead, Christ comes in this very unexpected way, as we read about in the New Testament, where essentially we're talking about a person who is washing the disciples' feet, doing this acts of showing the person who's highest in authority is a servant. And so we understand authority then as servanthood ministry. And so it's the authority to serve God's people everywhere, as opposed to rule them. And so it is a different view of that. And that's a different view we have, I think, now than we had 70 years ago. So.
Oh, that's a lot, John.
I'm sorry that I didn't breathe there. So you couldn't jump in. I'm sorry.
No, you did great.
Okay.
So, I mean, this is a lot. So let me just ask a few little specific questions that people might be wondering. So I have heard in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints that they have, once they are ordained, once a boy is ordained at the age of 12 or 11.
Wow. Now,
I know, I'm really young. They have a list that takes them back. They have a list of people that takes them back to Jesus.
Yep.
Right? Or
could be, yeah, sure. In the same way that you can do your genealogy back to Adam if you want. So I don't even know. So, but anyway, that's not quite the same, because depends on how you look at this thing. So it goes to a certain point, and then it'll get to Peter, James, and John, and then Jesus, right? So it goes to, it's not a, the only reason why that's the same as doing your genealogy back to Adam is it doesn't, it, that last part is relying on something that's not historical, but it's something that is about belief.
I will admit, every time you say Peter, James, and John, I think Peter, Paul, and Mary, and I don't know why. I don't know why. But Community of Christ, RLDS, used to do that as well. And we stopped doing that when we, in the 50s, like you said, when we kind, or 60s, 70s, when we started moving away from the idea that we're the one true church, correct?
Yeah. Well, so, you know, okay, so there's a... I think there's something interesting about that document. And so I think that if we're doing it, I think that it would be, so I think it's sad that in Community of Christ, we aren't as aware of our forebearers. I spend a bunch of time talking about all of the pastors that went before me in this long line that goes back to 1836, you know, in Toronto, and that I want to be very aware of, you know, all of the faithful stewards that sacrificed to bring us to where we are as we have a Community of Christ here in the 21st century. And I think, unfortunately, our kind of extreme, you know, just not worrying about history and thinking about other things that has happened in the last 70 years in Community of Christ has meant that we forget that the members in the reorganization have, in many cases, much deeper roots in the restoration than members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, in part because they're so much better at converting people, you know? And so as a result of not being very good at it, the people in Community of Christ often have roots that go all the way back to the Kirtland era. And a lot of people just don't know it, you know? And so, I mean, the people who you go around and meet, you realize, you know, I know people in Community of Christ who are descendants of Alpheus Cutler, who are descendants of James Strang, you know, who are descendants, you know, of Charles B. Thompson, all of the different interesting characters, because they're all, you know, the Whiteites, you know, of Lyman White. You know, that's, we know everybody who's these descendants, but we don't really hardly talk about it. And so I do think that, that there would be a value to having a document like that in order to just be thoughtful and mindful of the fact that you have a continuity of stewardship and that we're remembering that. The problem, though, is that when we, the reason why we got rid of things like that, I think, is that you then, if you think of it as magic and you think that there's power in that humans have and that they have like a exclusive title to or something like that, it's theologically a very problematic position for all kinds of different reasons. And so like already, let's say in antiquity, in Christianity, there was an argument in the third century in Africa, third and fourth century in Africa. So Africa, Northern Africa, Tunisia used to be a major Christian heartland. And so what happened was there's a persecution, all kinds of the bishops, like pretended that they weren't Christian anymore, you know, and just so that they wouldn't get killed by the Romans and thrown to the lions and this kind of thing. And when they came back, when the persecution was over, the people that had gotten thrown to the lions didn't like all the people who, you know, who had said, okay, no, I'm not Christian after all, you know, but now they are again. And so there ended up being this dispute where they're saying, okay, all of you guys aren't true Christians because you disavowed when the time came. And so therefore, all of the sacraments you perform are not valid. And so, but the problem with that position becomes logistically a nightmare if you actually start to take it. So every one of those bishops, every one of their ordinations doesn't count. Every one of the priests that they've ordained, every baptism doesn't count. So all the people now, all the way throughout, all the people they married, they're not married. In other words, all of those kind of things. And so if we were to do this thing where sacraments relied on human agency for them to be valid, you don't know in that chart, you don't know in that priesthood chart, which one of those people was in just grave apostasy or whatever by your own understanding of that. In other words, that they were having an affair right then, if that's what you would have think in that, in your worldview, that would make it and the person out of, you know, they shouldn't be taking the sacrament in the Mormon sense of it, right? So then your priesthood lineage doesn't work. And so in the same way that when you do the genealogy back to Adam, there's a very high chance, you know, in the course of once you're doing 40 generations, that there's not a genetic relationship that at some point. In other words, because somebody is believed to be the child there of those two parents, but in fact, and they were raised as them and everything like that, and yet there's infidelity. And so so it's quite possible that when you do it generationally like that, that it's not going to be the case. And so you can't do it literalistically. so literalistically, it wouldn't make any sense. And so if we, in my opinion, so that's why that was already in the third century declared a heresy. So in other words, it doesn't matter how bad your priest is, the sacrament still counts because it's from God. And so that's what the church decided. Like I say, Mormons don't necessarily care because that's during the Great Apostasy. But anyway, so that's what Christians decided for thousands of years. And I think that that's kind of where we also are at, which is, the authority here is coming as a direct covenant relationship that the individual has with God, and so that's anyway.
Like, I've never even thought about that. What a mess that would be. That would be a huge mess. And like, if we use the list, then it kind of takes away a little bit of that. It kind of would take us back to that one true church idea for me, because like, if we have a list, if someone asks you the question, where does your priesthood authority come from? You might go to the list rather than say it comes from God. So,
right. And it like lead to list shopping. So like a person could have, maybe people do this, it may well be that you like Parley P. Pratt. And so, you want to get somebody whose list takes you through people so that you can have higher status priesthood or something like that, because you've gone through, and then what I always never get about the list thing is, these boys are getting their first list when they're 11, but is that the one that's not the one they're using later, because they're later ordained to be an elder. And so now they would have a whole new list or whatever. And they're also later ordained to be a high priest or something. So is that always being overridden? I'm not sure how people are looking at it. I guess I understand it to be that every time you get a new ordination, you just get a whole new list or whatever, but I don't know.
Well, you know more about it than I do. I only knew there was a list. I didn't really know. So, sometimes when I'm talking to people about ordination and community of Christ, especially when seekers, when ex-LDS become community of Christ, we talk about priesthood and they're like, they automatically think that you're higher automatically, mm-hmm. right? Because you have that title.
Yeah.
And I say, no. It's actually a lowering of yourself. It's a servant ministry. And that is so mind-blowing to so many seekers that I talk to, because we don't raise ourselves up. I'm like, priesthood is actually kind of a pain and it's really, really hard.
Yeah.
It's not something to aspire to necessarily, because you have to work hard. Do you want to talk a little bit more about the hierarchy?
I want to say that we are only, that's aspirational for us. We're only getting there, so I'm very much I've gone into old Community of Christ chapels where they still have like three thrones that are up at the front, and you're like, that's kind of that doesn't really model what we're trying to do with, I think that's kind of a traditional RLDS configuration where there's essentially three thrones that are at the front with two pulpits, and it's a raised dais. And, the reality of it is, I had, so there's a suburban congregation here that's one of our daughter congregations in Scarborough, and they built the building 40 years ago. And so, and they have there was a raised dais, and, if you weren't in priesthood, you weren't allowed on that thing. And so, I had a woman who was talking about, how she was in, doing, I don't know, like ministry, but in the 70s, but, she stepped up on this thing, and then she got like booed down, pushed, told not to do that, by the priesthood authorities, which were all male back then, And so I think that we, it's not been forever that long ago that, I've been to the churches today, where the thrones are still kind of there. And what I mean by that is a big fancy chair that's sort of like in the LDS people will know from General Conference, where they've got all 15 of the fancy chairs that are up in front. We would have had three for the presiding elder of the congregation and the two counselors often. And anyway, so I've seen those within the last few years, even that just because once you have a nice chair, it's hard to take it down, you know, or whatever. But anyway, that's kind of, but it's not modeling what we want to be modeling in terms of servanthood ministry. And so what I would say is that my experience in my congregation and certainly how I've seen you model priesthood in Salt Lake is what we're talking about, but we're still, it's aspirational in that we are trying to achieve that. It's still been a little bit complicated to go from a priesthood that was viewed hierarchically and was viewed in sort of a way as, you know, in a sense, gradations, you know? And so we have done a thing where we've taken, you know, going all the way from deacon to prophet, and we've taken it and put it this side, you know, this way. And so we have a chart now that it's just all side by side, and it shows disciple, which is to say people who are members who are not in priesthood, and all of their responsibilities all the way to president of the church, prophet president. But nevertheless, we still have some rules around priesthood and around sacraments that are a little bit exclusionary. And so we haven't totally come to terms with it all ourselves, but we're moving forward is what I'd say.
Well, we're certainly trying.
Yeah.
And like, we're trying so hard not to be hierarchical, but it's really hard when you say that a deacon cannot ordain an elder.
Right.
Like that implies some sort of hierarchy, even yeah. though, gosh, we try so hard not to make that happen.
Yeah. I mean, and there's all these rules, and I was ordained as a 70 a couple of years ago here, and the rules aren't always clear what they are. And I was like trying to figure out, okay, well, so can a high priest help out in ordaining a 70, or who's allowed to put their hands? You know what I mean? It's like, what's the rules here? You know, because we still have these rules, you know? And so exactly how that works, you know, it isn't always clear, because in some cases, you know, it's spelled out for how you do it with an elder, but we don't really know for maybe 70s, or at least it's not written down anywhere. I could find it very easily. So anyway, it's still an ongoing, you know, thing. And we also, part of it is intentionally, we view priesthood and also maybe more especially sacraments, you know, with very intentional reverence. You know, we don't, I think we try not to view this as literalistic or having some kind of anyway, like it's like an energy of their own that's not of God, but anyway, you know, like anything like that. But it's something that nevertheless inspires deep meaning. And so we also know that if we do things without that kind of mindfulness and that thoughtfulness, or if we do things that are extraordinarily different or things like that, it can be meaningful to some people, but it can be very dissonant to other people. And so we have approached those things very cautiously.
Yeah. I've heard people talk about, even for the last, I don't know, 10, 20 years, like, what if we just dissolved priesthood completely in Community of Christ? And maybe just because it's been a product of my life, I can't even wrap my head around what that means, simply because of the sacraments, actually. Because when I know when I'm performing a sacrament, I am prayerful beforehand. I try to prepare myself and be ready. And because I feel that real weight of responsibility on me, and I just don't understand how that could look. Also, you know, in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, when, you know, there's the big ordained women movement, I can't wrap my head around what it would look like for women to be ordained in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in the structure they have now.
Yeah.
I mean, boys are ordained at 11 or 12. Would girls be ordained? Like, everybody would be
They should
ordained.
Be, yeah. Yeah.
Well, they absolutely should be. But would everybody be ordained then? Like, I just can't even wrap my head around what that would look like. I mean, it does.
Well, I mean, it's already unusual, right? So the early church structure was not that all men and boys were ordained, you know? So that's one thing that we have maintained that they haven't, which is to say this universal ordination of half of the population, and specifically not of the other half, is unusual. And so, and that's not what was going on in the early church. So the early church, my great, great, great grandfather joined and, you know, was made a teacher, you know, and so it was not a calling for 14-year-olds. It was for, he was 38 or something like that at the time, you know what I mean? And so, and a lot of other people were not ordained, you know what I mean? So that's not that everybody instantly became an elder or a high priest who was a male, and women nothing. And certainly, anyway, so certainly deacons were not 11-year-old boys. They were kind of these rough, you know, kind of Wild West kind of guys, the guys who were not going to speak on the pulpit, but who maybe were, you know, going to make sure the meetings were, I don't know, you can move the chairs around on the one hand, but on the other hand, making sure that nobody's disrupting the meeting, you know, kind of thing, you know. So these are, anyway, so those were more what the deacons would have been like back then, as opposed to, you know, so it's a little bit strange, but the part of the thing is that it's, they have a strange system already where almost half of the people are ordained. And so we just have to either not have everybody be ordained or have everybody be ordained.
Well, I mean, just when I think about the ordained women movement, it's a much bigger issue than, I mean, the more you think about it, the bigger it becomes for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And I don't mean to harp on it. I just, you know, I sit in Salt Lake, right, in the heart of where this is happening, and people talk about it so often, and I'm just like, it would have to be an entire overhaul of the entire structure. It's a pretty big deal. So, go ahead.
Yeah, and we, you know, when you're talking about whether we could operate without priesthood, that would also be, you know, just like you say, it's such a completely crazy. I mean, it's such a different overhaul from how the whole church has been structured and throughout all of our history and how our understanding of everything. That said, we could potentially be open to different ways that we understand it, and we maybe should be open to more different ways. And I actually, I don't know. This is just the, I think we should be open to dialogue on this. I'm not saying what we should do or what we shouldn't do. I just say ideas that we could be open to, I think, are things like, even though there are traditional things that we understand deacons or priests or elders to be able to do, and other people, other, you know, deacons to not be able to do, that we maybe nevertheless should not eliminate exclusionary requirements and say instead, as a deacon, you may well, find meaning in doing some of the traditional things, and you may well find meaning in your calling doing some other things. But we aren't saying that that it's a limited calling in any way, you know, or, and that kind of a thing. I don't know. So we may want to rethink some of our exclusionary rules. But on the other hand, I think the way that it should always work is that rather than saying there's a place behind which, you know, this isn't, you know, the hard literalistic no, but rather instead, there's lots of possibilities, but we maybe want to uphold, you know, a certain, you know, this one as being the main thing you might be doing, you know, or something like that, you know, but not telling you can't do something else, you know, so.
This is a very interesting conversation. I haven't thought about this for a really long time, although as a pastor, and you know this, it's a really big responsibility calling someone to priesthood.
Yes.
And it's a scary responsibility calling someone to priesthood. And I'm glad I don't have to do it completely alone. I have a pastoral leadership team that I can talk to about it, but it's a really big and weighty responsibility. Have you found that true for you?
Yeah, because, I mean, I can't go into any details about it, but I found it to be life-changing for people involved, right? And because of that, you know, when through discernment of the Holy Spirit, when you are able to recognize something in somebody that they maybe don't even see in themselves, and that maybe because they haven't been given that affirmation, you know, that they haven't looked within themselves for that sense of calling to that thing, even though you can totally see they would be there, you know, and so that can be just really, really amazing. But the other part of it is that, you know, you can, there are times when you feel that you're seeing that so much, this isn't not, I'm talking about priesthood calling, but now I'm thinking about an administration when, where it was a blessing of comfort that I really felt like I could see what the person's need was. And I felt like I was really expressing that. And then I felt like the person really didn't listen to that, you know. Anyway, you know, so it's just, but that's just in my set. And so I can't only worry about it from what my perspective of it is, because what the, like I said at the beginning of this thing, when I was talking about the whether or not the sacrament is valid when somebody who is not, is completely unworthy is doing it, it's not me that's doing it. And so it's not, what's important is even an administration or an ordination, the sacrament is occurring between the person and God, and as they are covenanting. And so what is the Holy Spirit saying to them and speaking to them? I can, it's wonderful for me to be able to participate and to bring, you know, my insights or whatever I might have to them. But anyway, at the end of the day, it's between them and God. So.
Well, yeah, to come full story, full circle back to my first story, right? When she said, where do you get your priesthood authority? And I rather flippantly, it really was flippantly.
Oh, yeah.
God. I'm so glad that I wasn't completely off base in community. Well, that's what I've always been taught. But sometimes when you look back at what you've been taught, sometimes it's not exactly where we are now. So I'm glad that was still good to go.
Yeah.
So, John, I've really appreciated this conversation. Is there something else that you think we should talk about that we haven't talked about yet?
Not necessarily. I think part of it has been, I want to bring up the fact that where we are at is a place that it's not that we have that we've got this all figured out and we know exactly what we're doing. And so we shouldn't be coming as Community of Christ from a place of, well, we're always right and we know what's going on. In fact, actually, I was like even trying to I was reading some of our, I don't know if these are backwards anyway. So anyway, you know, some of our more recent books on authority in the RLDS tradition, theological tradition, and a theology colloquy thing, authority, membership, and baptism. And so anyway, I was just starting to look at even what our kind of current resources are onto this question. And I would actually say that as close as these are, we're pretty good at knowing what our idea used to be and why we don't think that. But we aren't as good at explaining where we got our idea now and how do we justify it and how do we understand it in a systematic sense or in a theologically sound sense. And there's even a very good caution in this book anyway, that in some cases Community of Christ by not having laid out our theological foundation as well as maybe we should, when we are attracted to an idea that seems good and right, we maybe adopt it without actually realizing what we're deconstructing and two, what are the underlying premises of all of the different theological background that, of this thing we're adopting. And so that's why, anyway, as I'm trying to ever wrestle with these questions, I do try to put it into as broad a historical context as possible to do kind of the research and understand how Christians have throughout time in primitive church, antiquity, Middle Ages, Protestantism, and everything like that, the Restoration, how do we kind of wrestle with these questions, but not ever saying that we, you know, have the definitive answer, but we are always open to, you know, new light and truth, you know?
I think that is very well put. And I think that you understand Community of Christ so well in so many ways. When you say that, you know, like we understand where we came from in some way, in a lot of ways we understand because where we came from seems to have very definite answers.
Yeah.
It's like, oh yes, this is true. And this is true. And this is true. And
now, and that is not true.
Exactly. That is not it. And now where we are now, truth, whatever that means, becomes a little bit hazier and we don't have definitive answers. Our answers are, you know, we believe that God is calling us to do this, but if we're wrong, we're going to try and fix it. We believe blah, blah, blah. And so it's just not as concrete as it used to be. And so I do think a lot of our people are a little scared to say that this is the answer. And I kind of understand that. I work in Community of Christ. I've worked with them for 15 years. And I still am sometimes worried about what the church is saying and what, you know, I kind of get a little worried.
Yeah, well, I'll just say, so like last month, I went to the meeting of the Canadian Council of Churches, which is our ecumenical body in Canada, as a visiting member, as one of the two delegates representing Community of Christ in Canada. And they were, you know, they're considering our, we're an affiliate, but they're considering us as a full member. And so one of the things they're very worried about is because of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints rejects Trinitarianism. They reject a lot of, you know, it has a very different Christology and theology than all the rest of Christianity. And so they're very worried about that with us. And so nevertheless, if you get to, you're talking to, let's say, like one of the leading Greek Orthodox theologians of the era right now, you know, who is the representative of the Ecumenical Patriarchate of Constantinople for Canada. And he is quizzing you on Chalcedonian Christology, you know, and how good is our, it's pretty easy to, walk into heresy when you ever try to talk about the Trinity for more than a minute. So anyway, I totally understand where you're coming from about just like, I think we say this.
Wow. Well, John, what you're describing happens to me basically every day. So, you know, like, that's no problem. I always have to talk to the foremost authority in the Greek Orthodox Church, blah, blah, blah. Oh my gosh, John, that sounds terrifying. thank God.
It was fun. He was great. Yeah. I made a joke with him, so.
That's always good. That's my go-to if things get uncomfortable as well. I get it.
Yeah.
Well, John, thank you so much for being on the podcast. Thank you for sharing your knowledge with us. This has been so enlightening for me. And when I get asked that question again, I'm just going to be like, we have this great podcast for you to listen to, which is one of my favorite things to do.
Very good.
Wonderful to be with you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to Project Zion Podcast. Subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcast, Stitcher, or whatever podcast streaming service you use, and while you are there, give us a 5-star rating. Project Zion Podcast is sponsored by Latter-day Seeker Ministries of Community of Christ. The views and opinions expressed in this episode are of those speaking and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of Latter-day Seeker Ministries or Community of Christ. The music has been graciously provided by Dave Hines.